Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, how the changing face of the holy city of Jerusalem is affecting peace and Christians. A new study encourages the U.S. administration to harness the positive power religion can bring to promoting peace. And we speak to the U.S. State Department's special representative to Muslim communities about her job. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's U.S. trip has focused world attention on his government's settlement policies. Well, today we'll be hearing of a lesser-known project changing the face of Jerusalem.
What I think is taking place here is a radical transformation of the nature of the whole of the public domain in the area surrounding the old city of Jerusalem, which is full of holy sites.
Daniel Seideman is a Jewish lawyer who founded an Israeli nonprofit, nonpartisan organization advocating for a stable Jerusalem for Arabs and Jews, which ensures the dignity and welfare of all its residents, safeguards their holy places, and their historical and cultural heritages. Well, while much world attention is being focused on expanding Jewish settlements into the Palestinian West Bank, Seideman is concerned about what he calls more subtle efforts to appropriate land in the old city of Jerusalem. It's dubbed the excavation project of the Holy Basin surrounding the old city, an area where tens of thousands of Palestinians live. Saturated with religious, historical, national, and cultural interests, the Holy Basin, Seideman says, is the most sensitive issue for the city. On a recent trip to Jerusalem, I asked him to share his concerns and what they may mean for Christians.
Over the past several years, virtually all of the most important religious, cultural, archaeological sites in this area have been turned over to exclusionary settler organizations with the trappings of a settler evangelical theme park.
What are the areas most affected, and what sort of media coverage is this getting?
The areas covered are principally Mount of Olives, Mount Zion, City of David, Silwan, all of which resonate with Jewish, Christian, and Muslim history. And that's the focus. This is, you need a thermal map. Not everything glows with the same intensity. Now, in terms of press coverage, to be honest, for a long time, we have sort of kept this out of the press. We've been trying to address it quietly because it is of such explosive potential. But it has been receiving attention, and we're trying to expose this in order to get friends of Israel to engage my government in order to put a stop to what we consider to be highly irresponsible actions.
You sound like you're saying that it could be a dangerous, explosive project.
If this continues, Jerusalem erupts, and it erupts in a way that will send tremors throughout the region and destabilize the region. This is not only a cultural issue, this is a regional and global security issue.
And how will this plan affect the Catholic Church and Christian sites here?
You know, there's no hostility towards the Church in these plans, but they don't exist. The Christian equity is not being factored in. And there's the real threat of the marginalization of Christian sites and institutions and communities in this area, as a Muslim as well. And I think that this is a threat to the integrity of those institutions.
Could we look at the Mount of Olives for a moment? Because that seems one of the areas that's most contentious.
Mm-hmm. There's settlement activity going on the Mount of Olives, a new settlement scheme nestled between the Lutheran World Federation and the home of the nuncio. The Mount of Olives is indeed a holy site for Jews. It's the site of an ancient burial ground, which is of enormous importance to myself as a Jew. But it is also where Jesus wept. It is also Gethsemane. It is also Domius Flavius. And Jerusalem is Jerusalem in its ability to allow Jewish, Christian, and Muslim narratives to cohabit the same space simultaneously, and that is at risk now.
And also you mentioned the area of Silwan, the city of
Silwan
David.
Silwan is probably the major battlefield because that is biblical Jerusalem and has been targeted most intensively by the settler organizations, who are not only taken over homes, but the national parks and the archaeological sites and the ground underneath the Palestinian homes by means of tunneling. And that is literally a battlefield.
You mentioned the effects on the Christian community. What about on the Muslim community?
You know, it's easier in Israel to be hostile to the Muslim community. There's no factoring of the Muslim concerns here. It would be probably impossible to coordinate with this with the Muslim Waqf authorities, but there's been no attempt to do so. This is about sovereignty and expressing Israeli sovereignty, and the Islamic community is going to be a tolerated, marginalized minority under this scheme.
What are you asking exactly from the Israeli government?
Stop. Take the matches away from the pyromaniacs. Do nothing without total transparency. Engage all of the stakeholders and protect the religious, cultural, and historical integrity of the city of Jerusalem.
Do you think that it will your plans will have any resonance with the Israeli population?
I believe so if they're articulated well, but I think that Friends of Israel need to engage both the Israeli government and the Israeli public and explain to the Israeli people their concerns. Because I think engaging Israel on the subject is not hostile to Israel. I think it's helping Israel do what's right.
If it does the wrong thing by not acknowledging sensitivities of other faith communities, Seideman says Israel can expect more violence, like the kind we've seen around the Jewish Temple Mount and Islam's holy mosque Al-Aqsa. And here, Seideman says, Christian faith leaders can play a powerful role.
Be our allies, as they are, to articulate to their communities, their churches, to the church establishments, and to the countries in which they operate, the concerns. The believers have a stake in the city of Jerusalem, and they should articulate their concerns in the appropriate places to get the churches and the governments to engage on this issue.
Can the Christian community here be a force for peace that has not been tapped yet?
100% yes. Not only the Christian community here. For too long, the discourse on Middle East peace has been dominated by a very large group of evangelical Zionists who are very extreme, and a small group of Israel bashers where Israel can do no right. And that's not the overwhelming majority of the Christian community throughout the world, who are pro-Israel, pro-Palestine, pro-peace, and pro-Holy Land. And that is an untapped source of energy. And if there's going to be peace, we have to avail ourselves of the energies in these communities.
And finally, negotiations on a series of accords between the State of Israel and the Holy See have been on hold, standby, let's say, over more than 10 years now. What would you like to see as action on the part of the Holy See in trying to determine the outcome of this project?
Persist until there's an agreement. You know, there's been a radical transformation in the relations between Jews and Christians in the last 50, 60 years. The issues are difficult issues, but we all have an interest in establishing and regularizing these relations. Keep at it until we succeed.
Seideman was speaking to me after a presentation of his findings on the Jerusalem Basin Project at a conference in the Old City. I caught the Franciscan Custos of the Holy Land, Gian Battista Pizzaballa, on the sidelines of that event and asked him to respond to some of the points Seideman raises.
Unfortunately, I'm very familiar with that project because we are, as Franciscans, that we have many properties here in Jerusalem, Old City, very hard pressure from the Israeli authorities in order to cooperate with them.
And what are your concerns for the Franciscan properties, but not just, also the ones of the Christian community, especially on the Mount of Olives?
We are in between. We need to develop and use the properties, housing projects, holy places, the new needs for pilgrims. We have properties close to the holy places, so we need to use them. At the same time, in order to use them to develop the property, we need permissions, authorizations that only the Israeli authorities can give. At the same time, we strongly want to defend and custody the actual character of Jerusalem, which is a universal character where the different religions live together peaceful, more or less peacefully, and where the Christian character is preserved also.
The person that we were listening to this morning, a Jewish lawyer who is speaking about this particular project, he's criticizing very strongly the activities of whom he sees as extremist settlers as promoting this particular plan and undermining the Christian presence here. What is your view about that?
I totally agree. Jerusalem cannot be only Jewish with some Christian and Muslim nuances, or Christian and neglecting the Jews, Muslim neglecting the others. Jerusalem always has been a city where Jews, Christians and Muslims live together. They had their holy places where the Christian character for our Christians is defined very well by the holy places and the Christian communities, and we have to defend and to custody these sort of status quo.
One of the plans for this new project is consists also of 11 archaeological sites and tunneling underneath Palestinian homes. How will that affect the lives of Palestinians in that area?
Everything you want to do in Jerusalem will affect heavily the sensitiveness of all the inhabitants. You can just move a stone and all the city will change, will come out with screaming, with problems and so on. So every initiative, unilateral initiative, without the consent of the other sensitiveness will create problems.
Why has no one, very few people outside of Israel and Palestine, why have so few people heard about this project?
This project is not a public project. The project that we discovered little by little by the gestures and the initiatives of the government, but no one knows in all the details this project. We understood that there is a project, a plan, but we don't know exactly how big and what is the content of this plan.
So obviously the Christians here in this land would like to have more transparency about this project.
Of course, absolutely.
What would you like to see Christians who are hearing this broadcast around the world, what would you like them to do to support the Christians here?
First of all, it is important for the Christian community all the world to be present here. First of all, to come with the pilgrimages and show that this city belongs also spiritually to the Christians. Second, the Christians all over the world to make pressure to create a public to the public opinion to inform them about what is happening here.
Father Gian Battista Pizzaballa is Franciscan Custos of the Holy Sites in the Holy Land. And earlier we heard Daniel Seideman, Jerusalem lawyer and founder of the Israeli advocacy group Ir Amim. From conflict over faith to the positive force of faith. I was intrigued when I met Notre Dame Professor Scott Appleby recently, fresh from presenting a report in Washington suggesting new ways the U.S. government can successfully engage religious communities abroad to promote a more peaceful world. The report by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs suggests that the success of American diplomacy over the next decade will be measured in no small part by its ability to connect with the hundreds of millions of people across the globe whose identity is defined by religion. Appleby explains that religion can be a positive force for good, a source to be harnessed.
We recognize that religious groups act both for ill but also for good and are incredibly influential in culture, society, and politics. So this report lays out a framework for rethinking the U.S. approach to religious communities. It builds on President Obama's speech in Cairo last June, and it thinks in more detail about how the United States can move forward to constructively engage religious communities.
And how are you proposing to do that? What sort of suggestions, concrete suggestions, are you making?
One suggestion is we ask the president to appoint an ambassador at large for religious freedom. That position is currently empty. And to make it clear that that ambassador's charge ought to be to clarify the meaning of religious freedom and the policy approach of the U.S. government so that it is no longer perceived as merely a tool to advance narrow U.S. interests, that is, religious freedom only for Christians who are proselytizing. Certainly Christians and other groups have the right to evangelize, to spread the faith, but religious freedom is a much more robust, a broader, an important concept. It's freedom for majority religious groups in a state as well as minorities, for all religious groups. And in many parts of the world, a state will repress religions, including majority religions. So we believe one path toward democratization, toward peace, in fact, is allowing religious groups to organize under the rule of law, not violently, not in an intolerant way, but to organize in a way that acknowledges civil process and debates public issues in an open and tolerant public square. So it's not appropriate to exclude religious actors. So that's one recommendation. The other is to increase religious literacy on the part of government bureaucracies in the United States, not merely Defense Department or State Department, but the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Energy, of Education, of Homeland Security, because the U.S. government is engaged around the world in all of these areas, in energy, in development, in environment, in mitigating religious conflict or all forms of conflict. And yet, our leading diplomats, many of our cabinet officials, people who are working around the world, are at this point illiterate when it comes to religious customs and cultures elsewhere, or some of them are more trained, more educated. But generally speaking, the government has not provided systematic and sustained education in the way religion operates on the ground. We're not talking about theology here in the highest sense or philosophy. We think that our government officials should have a greater respect for the dynamics of symbol and ritual and belief and practice within religious cultures so that they can interact with more insight. Every knowledge has to be local, and there's no textbook that will address this. So there has to be specialized knowledge, but it can't just be only about governmental structures or the economy, because all these things are intertwined. Religion, culture, philosophy, economy, military. These are not separated into silos in the real world, and yet our U.S. policy has separated them and compartmentalized religion and marginalized it. I'll give you a good example. USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, has worked in many parts of the world to partner with local leaders and governments to bring about greater economic development, which, of course, is tied to stability politically and to the reduction of conflict. When you begin to provide clean drinking water or education or health care to people, then the chances of violent extremism, of conflict, are mitigated, and furthermore, you're advancing human rights. Well, USAID has worked with religious groups because they recognize that if you don't work through the local imam in this section of Nigeria, for example, you're not going to build that healthcare clinic. You're not going to get people to attend it. You're not going to get a blessing for it, for example. And yet, to this point, when USAID has worked with religious actors like the local imam, they've had to do so on the sly, so to speak, quietly, and without kind of full, kind of a systematic authority to do so, frankly, because there's been a fear on government officials' part that to directly engage the local imam or rabbi or priest or guru in doing that, you're violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, which calls for no establishment of religion. In fact, our own legal scholars on this report have made it clear that there's no constitutional prohibition for engaging religious communities around the world. There may be some constraints upon how they are engaged. That is, do you want to promote a particular religion over another? Probably not. That probably does violate the Constitution.
And how do you avoid the impression that there's a hidden agenda here? You
know, that is clearly the big question and the hurdle for implementing this report. We call in very strong language for measures, steps to be taken to avoid any kind of manipulation of religion or instrumentalization. How do we use religion or try to intervene in debates to favor U.S. policy? We have documentation of how that has failed in the past. You cannot intervene from outside in internal religious debates. Religion is not manipulable and shouldn't be. The attempt to manipulate it often fails. So we call for partnerships and networks that are mutual and that often occur beyond government. That is, through business alliances, through higher education in the U.S., through civic organizations, through a variety of rights organizations. There is a role for government. And I mentioned agencies like USAID or the Department of Energy. There has to be sensitivity. But in terms of this collaborative partnership, that can often take place on the non-governmental level, and we call for greater attention to that across the board in the United States.
What sort of recommendations are you giving this administration on how to engage countries where, say, Christian minorities are subjected to violence or discriminations, even in their codes of law?
Right. We have a very strong section on religious freedom, and we call for really a bold attitude on the part of our administration based on the analysis that it has backfired in the past and it will ultimately hurt us if the United States government on one hand talks about freedom and human rights and democratization and then ignores the alliances we have with certain regimes and states that violate those principles. And we argue that in the long run, it's in our interest, our specific national interest, for the United States to be more consistent. Therefore, to demand that human rights, democratization, be honored as universal values, not merely American values. They're culturally adjusted, they're specific, and there's certainly security concerns. We're not suggesting freedom for terrorists, you know, freedom for those who break the law. But often repressive measures go way beyond the rule of law and, in fact, don't observe the rule of law. And yet we are often giving aid to such governments. And the report, very frankly, calls for a more consistent moral orientation to our policy, which we believe in this sense is not idealistic but is realistic.
Scott Appleby is a history professor at Notre Dame's Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. Well, it seems someone in Washington is listening to suggestions making engaging religions an important part of the U.S.'s international relations strategy. Chris Altieri sat down with the State Department's Special Representative to Muslim Communities, Farah Pandith, for a look at her globe-trotting job.
Very important in terms of the way in which we're doing things. We're talking about the diversity of Islam. And so a Muslim in Sao Paulo is as important to us as a Muslim in Cairo, as a Muslim in Almaty, as a Muslim in Jakarta. So we are engaging with our embassies across the board, trying to build bridges, to build partnerships, to open up dialogue on a people-to-people level.
But a Muslim community in Paris is different from a Muslim community in Lahore.
Absolutely. And you know what? A Muslim community, somebody who's living as a Muslim in Paris is not having the same experience as a Muslim even in Lyon or Marseille. And we have to really understand that there is a lot of diversity that's taking place around the world in terms of the experience of what's happening. The Secretary of State has asked me to engage on this people-to-people level, but she's asked me to really look very closely at the next generation of Muslims. So we're looking at the fact that, you know, 45% of the world's population is under the age of 30. How are we engaging with that demographic? How are we understanding what's taking place, and how important is it for us to be able to understand the differences that are taking place within these communities? It's quite significant. And so we have to be able to understand that the experience of somebody in Paris is very different from the experience in Lahore. There's not a one way of doing things. You have to have a multifaceted approach, and you have to have a nuanced approach, and you have to be very respectful of the nuances that are taking place within these communities.
It's clear that you're doing a lot of listening when you're out there. But what is the message? How does it fit into the broader mission?
So let me pull back for a minute and talk about the larger vision. The president very clearly stated in Cairo his engagement vision for Muslim communities around the world, built on mutual interest and mutual respect. And we are trying to build partnerships on a people-to-people level through my position, and trying to do as much as we can to not only listen but to act on what we hear. How can the U.S. government be the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with ideas that we hear on the ground? So for me, as we get to know different organizations and youth groups and faith leaders and teachers and activists, how can we actually take some of these ideas and make them into reality? There are things that are happening on a local level that are quite significant, and the American government can be that convener, that can be that connector. What we've done is we have been able to, in fact, think about the new ideas that are coming forward and be that bridge that connects those ideas. So that person that I meet in Kano, Nigeria, that has an incredible idea, can be connected with the person that I've met in Solo, in Indonesia, that is working on something very similar. And so we're making those kinds of connections. And we're trying to figure out ways in which we can go beyond the traditional mechanisms for diplomacy. We have explored over decades really wonderful exchange programs and international visitor programs, different kinds of exchanges. But what we want to do is take it beyond that and complement that approach by really being innovators and being the ones that are actually able to activate some of the ideas that we hear and turn them into action.
Can you give me a concrete example of that? You mentioned the guy with the great idea in, somewhere in Kenya, if I'm not mistaken, in Lake. But can you walk us through maybe how you've seen this actually happen?
Yeah, no, I understand. That we're focusing a lot on new media because a lot of young kids out there are using those tools to to speak to each other, to understand things. And so I met an entrepreneur who had a very interesting idea on how to facilitate something that doesn't exist on the web right now in terms of bringing ideas forward on what young people are doing with Muslims around the world. And so we heard that, and he was right. There isn't a place on the web in which you can go and hear what the next generation is feeling and doing and experiencing. So we have started to talk with them, him in terms of his idea, and connect him with others in other parts of the world that actually have said very similar things, and put them together with folks from Silicon Valley who, in fact, do this all day, every day. So you put those people together, you create a new idea, and hopefully it's seeded into something new. And this is, let me just be really clear, this is a long-term effort to build relationships. And it's not a one-off, what did you do, how many things did you seed, but rather, have we opened up opportunities for dialogue that didn't exist? Are we getting to know people we never would have known before? Are we listening to ideas that are percolating with this next generation? Are we doing everything that we can to use the might of the United States government to move forward and get these ideas into the mainstream? And I think that that's innovative and different, but more importantly, it must be done. We are at a moment in time when so much activity is taking place on the planet and voices have not been heard. We need to make those voices heard.
You're talking about building dialogue, building bridges, building understanding. But once you've gotten that understanding, that's not all there is to it. I mean, we're not just clearing things up. There are some real issues once you...
Of course. And listen, this is not an effort in which we are trying to become more popular or we're trying to get them to like us. Building partnership means... being respectful of each other's differences, understanding where perspectives come from, find common ground to talk about things. You know, the Secretary of State in my swearing-in gave a really incredible speech about why it was important to engage with Muslims. And she said, you know, there are 1.4 billion Muslims on the planet. That's 1/4 of the world's population. And we have to be able to build partnerships with that demographic and seed initiatives together for the common good. There's a lot going on that is very difficult and can spark a lot of conflict in terms of foreign policy issues, but there's a lot of things that we as humans are working on together that are of interest to everyone, whether it's development or health or science or education or innovation or entrepreneurship, that we want to get folks involved in and seed things that will make stronger communities. And what we're really trying to do is try to help on that effort. This is not just my office doing this alone. There are many parts of the government that are engaged with trying to build bridges. And so there's a people-to-people piece of this, which is what I'm working on civil society. There's a government-to-government level that is going on day-to-day and as we try to resolve some of these conflicts. There's a lot happening in the in-between. We're trying to see where private sector can get involved in some of these initiatives that can take place and where non-traditional actors can come to the table to talk. It's incredible to be here in the Vatican as we think about issues of dialogue. I know the Vatican has done so much on interfaith and puts that forward in terms of using that as a tool. That is one of many tools that we must use. And I think it is up to all of us at this moment in time to do as much as we can to contribute and to explore every avenue for dialogue. The president was very clear in Cairo when he talked about mutual interest and mutual respect. And in order for that to happen, you have to take that first step forward. This is a long-term commitment on behalf of our government to build partnerships with Muslim communities around the world that are built on the president's vision of engagement on mutual interest and mutual respect. And what we really want to do is get to know the next generation and find ways that we as the United States government can be the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with ideas that we hear on the ground and move them forward so that we can seed things together, some of which have never happened before, and some of these ideas are new and inventive, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to happen in the future.
Farah Anwar Pandit is the State Department Special Representative to Muslim Communities. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.